Today on the Lazy RPG Talk Show, we're going to look at a couple of different Kickstarters, including the Planestriders Kickstarter and Surviving Strange Hollow. I'm going to talk about NASA's RPG adventure. What does that mean for the RPG community now that NASA is writing D&D adventures? Chaosium is having a design challenge. We're going to look into that. I'm going to talk about what notes we might want to be taking during our session and after our session. What are the most important things for us to jot down so that we can keep the continuity of our campaigns going from adventure to adventure? And we're going to cover more questions from the March 2024 Patreon Q&A, all today on the Lazy RPG Talk Show. I'm Mike Shea, your pal from Sly Flourish, here to talk about all things in role-playing games. This show is brought to you by the patrons of Sly Flourish. Patrons get access to all kinds of awesome stuff, including tools to help them run their games, exclusive adventures, previews of upcoming products like the City of Arches Sourcebook, Uncovered Secrets Volume 1 and 2, tons and tons of stuff that you get for being a patron of Sly Flourish. It is a very low price, and to the patrons of Sly Flourish, thank you so much for your outstanding support. I did not have a show last week because I was sick. I got a cold. And when I have a cold, I can't come on and talk. So what I did instead is I wrote a newsletter of the kinds of things that I would have covered in last week's show. You can find a link to this newsletter in the show notes. It covers basically the same kind of stuff that I talk about on the show, broken out by different topics, sent out as a Sly Flourish newsletter and posted to the Sly Flourish website. So you can find that on the Sly Flourish website. But really what you should do is sign up for the Sly Flourish newsletter. If you are if you're listening on the podcast feed or watching over YouTube, but you like what you see and you want more of it, and on that rare occasion where I miss a show and I put out a newsletter, you want to be able to get that, the best thing you can do is sign up for the Sly Flourish newsletter. You get a weekly RPG-related newsletter every week that covers like a big RPG topic and then has links to all of the other work that I do, whether they are YouTube videos or podcasts. I have my DM tips. Every one of them at the bottom, I put 7 DM tips from my last week. All of those are available in the Sly Flourish newsletter. It's absolutely free to sign up. You get a free adventure generator for signing up. It's really useful. But the newsletter for this last show went out over that. And I felt bad because I was like, oh, there's a bunch of people on YouTube or on podcasts who probably aren't subscribed to the newsletter and they're not going to even know what's going on. So if you want to stay in touch and know what's going on, the newsletter, the Sly Flourish newsletter, is totally the way to do it. So some of the topics that I covered last time, I talked about the new map features in D&D Beyond. I had actually spent a little time on Twitch playing with it, but I thought it was really good, so I talk about that. The new Marilith preview that was available for Tales of the Valiant, we talked about that. Bob Worldbuilder on DM Regrets, a fantastic video you should check out. I did a little blurb about the Dread Lair Anomicon, a new product by Raging Swan Press, which is really, really excellent. Please check that out. Dune is on the Humble Bundle. Is this still going on? I think it's still going on. Yeah, Dune has a huge Humble Bundle, $18 for 17 products. It seems like I'm actually going to go see Dune tomorrow. I'm very excited to see the new Dune Part 2 tomorrow. And so if you're into Dune and you want to get some cool art, you want to look at their RPG, this is the best way, $18 to look at their RPG. I talked about being good stewards of the hobby and what that meant, some links to it, or some bullets about that topic. Simple online combat tracking, a little tip about how to do better online combat tracking. And then I talked about Patreon questions, took some of my highlighted Patreon Q&A from the remainder of February. So all of that is in that Sly Flourish newsletter. You can get it and read it and enjoy it and pick up all the same kind of stuff that I talk about on the talk show from last week is available in that newsletter. Planestrider is a new Kickstarter project that is coming out, or that is out. They've got 60,600, almost 700 backers with 25 days to go. A new project by EN World Publishing, the publishers of the Level Up Advanced 5e system that is compatible with all of 5e and Level Up Advanced 5e. This is where we're getting into this new realm that products are 5e compatible, which means different systems can use them, which I think is really kind of cool. And the Planestriders Journal is one of these projects. You can pick this up. Let's see. The rewards that you can select include PDF copy is about $26. So that's a pretty good price for it. The fine people over at EN World Publishing sent me a full copy of this book to preview today. So we're going to just dive into it a little bit and take a look at what we get. This was a complimentary copy given to me for this show. And one of the things that's really cool about the way that EN World does their Kickstarters is their books are already done. So once the Kickstarter is complete, you know that you're going to get the PDF version of that book sent to you within, I think it's within hours. I think they send it out really, really quickly. because it's already complete. They've already finished all the design, all the editing, all of the artwork, all of the stuff is already in it. It is a complete version. Obviously, the print version will take some time to them for them to do. It is a 267-page PDF for the core book. There's an adventure book as well. I didn't get a chance to take a look much at the adventure book. And this is their take, according to Russ Morris from EN World. He described this book as the manual of the planes for A5E, that it doesn't follow the same cosmology that the typical D&D plane breakout has. It's their own take on the planes, but that's the kind of material that you find in this book. There's a bunch of different character options, including new archetypes for, I think every class has a new archetype, some extra feats, new origins that you can tie to your characters, and then gets into the main book. So there's about 50 pages of it are character driven stuff out of 267 pages, which means about 215-20-ish pages are focused on the GM focused stuff, which includes the how you get around in the planes, but then a big bulk of the book is on the planes themselves. What are all of the different planes that exist? The transitive planes, the elemental planes. The elemental planes all have unique names now. They're not just plane of fire, earth, air, and water. And then other planes of existence that go around. There is an adventure included in here. I think Saga of Surim. Seventh level adventure that you can run in the planes. So gives you a nice thing to just grab onto and immediately run in your game. But I'm always, whenever I look at a book like this, I'm always really interested in the planes themselves, the things that you actually get and learn about from the planes. So nice. I like this, like a good one page description of each of the different planes that exist and what makes sense there. What is it about these planes that are good? Their version of the cosmology, some really great art. I like their Far Realm out, right? Tentacle, IB. Beasts. So good descriptions of each of the planes and, you know, lots of material that you could just use. So if you are into planar adventuring or want to add planes, a neat way that you can use planes in your game is as bits of lore. So you had that one page description that showed you all the different elements of the planes. If you decide you want to throw some weird worlds, even if you're using a normal like D&D cosmology for your world, there's infinite planes out there, right? You could say, oh, there's planes that don't fit in the cosmology. You can drop some of these ideas in there. So, you know, one of the nice things about all of our RPGs is there's really no reason when we all are operating in a multiverse style environment in our games, all of the planes can work, right? You don't ever have to say, oh no, that doesn't work in this world, right? Or I can't introduce these other planes. No, you can pretty much introduce whatever planes you want from any source that you want, regardless of who published them or regardless of what came out. So there doesn't have to be a fixed planar architecture that says, no, there really are no other planes. The abyss is an example, right? The abyss is infinite. There's infinite layers of the abyss. There could be anything. How many, if it's infinite, that means every instance is there somewhere. That means there are good abyssal planes, right? But that's just the abyss. You could, of course, say like the outside of it, or did just, you know, in between, every time you see a line between two different worlds, there could be an infinite number of worlds inside of those lines. So a really useful book from that perspective, and it gives a lot of interesting stuff in here. So anyway, I saw it and I was like, yeah, I'm backing it. And even though I got a preview copy of it, I still backed the Kickstarter. So I put my money where my mouth is and backed this product because I think it looks really cool. And I think it's a really fun resource that you can drop in and dive into your game. I think a common question would be, how does this compare to the Plane Breaker book from Monte Cook Games? And they both look really cool. They both have very good artwork. They both have a really neat design. And I don't know that I would say like, oh God, you have to pick one over the other. I'm not going to make that determination. I wouldn't say. I'd say you'd probably want to look at both books and decide which ones you want to get, because both of them have tremendous amounts of lore that you can use. I will say this. I think that when it comes to 5e design, the design of actual monsters and stuff for 5e, that the 5e design that EN World Publishing has done is better than what I've seen coming out of Monte Cook Games for 5e. Monte Cook Games makes outstanding worlds, beautiful art, some of the best looking physical books I've gotten for RPGs have been coming out of Monte Cook Games. I haven't been crazy about their 5e design. There's some weird things that they do with 5e monsters and stuff like that just don't quite fit the style that I expect for 5e monsters. where Eon World Publishing, they're bringing in people like Paul Hughes. I don't know if Paul had any involvement in the monster design for this book, and I don't know who did the monster design for this book, and I didn't really look at the monster design, so I can't tell you if it's actually better from the perspective of Plane Breaker versus Plane Strider, but I typically have very much liked the monster design that you find in, it's coming out of Eon World Publishing. So that is the Plane Strider's Journal from EN World Publishing, available on Kickstarter now. Give it a look. It looks really cool. A bunch of friends of mine and a bunch of excellent designers, including Sean Merwin, James Hake, Dan Dillon, Ed Greenwood, and others, are working on a Kickstarter now called Surviving Strange Hollow. I didn't know this, but it is a project we love from Kickstarter. 728 backers with 25 days to go. It actually came out the same day that the Plane Striders book came out. So I heard people like, oh my God, how am I supposed to do? There's two of these things. I don't think that there is a preview of Surviving Strange Hollow. The one interesting thing about this Kickstarter is they have fully commissioned all of the art. The book is very heavily built around a beautiful hand-drawn art pieces that have their own particular style, and all of the art had already been commissioned for the work. So you at least know that all of the art is done. And, you know, really interesting stuff for, you know, like the creatures of Strange Hollow. I think it includes, let's see, explorers, adventurers, and fools. So there are new player options, new subclasses, same kind of book that, you know, we see a lot of this kind of thing of, you know, books that are providing lots of new bits for characters and lots of new bits for GMs as well. Looks pretty neat. So I don't know as much about this. There are lots of different videos that you can see. I heard many of the designers on the most recent Mastering Dungeons talked about this. So they had if you want to learn more about it and hear the perspective of the designers, you can hear something on Mastering Dungeons as well. So looks like a very beautiful product. I am going to be picking up the PDF of this book. It looks really neat. $30 for the PDF, $65 for the hardcover and PDF, and so on. So really neat stylized book written by many designers. Looks like they have a live stream here. I see my friend Sean Merwin there, and having done lots of press and interviews. So it looks like there's lots of material that you can read to learn more about the Surviving Strange Hollow Kickstarter. So looks really neat, and I like very, really good. Dan Dillon, it's neat to see Dan Dillon working on a design project now that he is no longer with Wizards of the Coast. He jumped right into a product like this. So I'm very eager and excited to see what this does, and happy to back it. That is the Surviving Strange Hollow Kickstarter. You can find a link to it in the show notes. We are having a sale on the Lazy DM's Companion on the Sly Flourish bookstore. If you go to the Sly Flourish bookstore, you can find a link. It is $5 off either version of the book. So that is 50% off the PDF and 20% off of the soft cover and PDF version of this book. It is worldwide. So wherever you are able to order it, you are able to get that $5 discount. It's automatically applied. You don't have to put in a coupon or anything like that. The sale's going on for like the next 10 days or so. So you probably want to get on it before you forget. It's a really good deal to put out there. I love the Lazy DM's Companion. I actually shot a whole other video where I kind of dove into it, so I'm not going to do that here. But you can also find other videos about the Lazy DM's Companion, and you can see me using like ideas from Lazy DM's Companion back when we ran the Kickstarter a couple of years ago, 3 years ago. I think it was during COVID, so it was three years ago or so, 4 years ago. I can't remember. 3 years ago, when I went through and like built adventures using the Lazy DM's Companion and talked a lot about what it's got. So there are other videos that talk about this. I'll link to those in the show notes so you can see them or listen to them. But I love this book. I use it all the time. I really feel like it is a really solid bridge between the Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master and the Lazy DM's Workbook. It is the third book in that series, and it's just packed. It's only 64 pages, but it is packed with stuff to help you generate ideas for your adventures, help you run your game, make it easier to run your game, help you with your prep. It takes some concepts from Return and blows them out a little bit. So like, what are examples of strong starts? What are different sources for secrets and clues? Lots of things like that. Bunch of maps that are included that you can use in your game. Really, really good product. So that is available on sale right now. $5 off either version of the book. That's 50% off. That means you can get the PDF for $5. $5 for the PDF and the map pack. And or you can pick up the soft cover version of the book for $20. That includes the PDF and soft cover version of the book. So there's a link to that in the show notes. You can get that on the Sly Flourish bookstore going on now. NASA. I don't know where this sits in the baloney. I think this is pretty high in the baloney metric for how popular TTRPGs and how popular like 5e and D&D has gotten. That NASA, a government organization, has made a D&D adventure. So they have an adventure called Lost Universes. NASA's tabletop role-playing game adventure, right? With a NASA logo and everything on it. Downloadable for free. They don't actually say it's compatible with D&D, and they don't even have the OGL license. I wonder if they just avoid licensing completely. It is a 5e event. Oh, that's cool. So we have somebody in our Twitch chat. Golden Buffalo says, I read the NASA adventure and I have to admit I was entertained. I haven't dove into it that much. It is for level 7 to 10 characters, so it's actually kind of a beefy adventure. If I were working at NASA, I would have made it like first to third level. But how cool is that, right? How cool is it that we have an adventure written by NASA? 45 pages, free adventure. Apparently teaches you stuff about the Hubble telescope and like sort of like alternate histories of what would happen if there wasn't the Hubble telescope. I don't know how it fits in the fantasy thing. I really didn't have time to dive in and read it. There is no reason you shouldn't go grab it, though, because it's absolutely free. It's got some cool actual artwork of our universe, public artwork of the universe. So they're rocket scientists, so they went very high level. That's pretty funny. But I just think you've hit a different, like, it was the only thing that compares this to me is when Wendy's made an RPG. And I guess there was a ton of controversy about the Wendy's RPG, which cracks me up a lot. But the idea that now NASA, you know, NASA has a D&D adventure, we've hit a different stage, right? We've hit a different world when NASA has an adventure. They have like a kind of a map, the Lost Universe map here for it. So yeah, I don't really get the, I didn't dive in to figure out what the adventure is, but I was just very amused that NASA has created an RPG adventure. I thought that was very cool. So you can find a link to it in the show notes if you haven't heard of it, and you can download your own free copy. There's no reason not to. It's a free RPG from NASA. So Chaosium, the company behind the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, who makes D100 role-playing games, is having a basic role-playing design challenge. They have $10,000 in prizes. Basically, if you're shortlisted with about 10 of them, you get $500 for it. Three winners get $2,000 each, and there's one People's Choice Award who gets $500 in addition to any other prizes. The intention is that you write your own role-playing game against using the basic role-playing universal game engine. The role-playing game engine, apparently, I was just looking at this, has like, but their main version is released under Orc, that the basic role-playing universal game engine PDF is released under the Orc license. So your own material that you write for them, though you would get an award for winning this, is still your own. They are not buying it from you. This isn't, there are some sleazy, you have to be careful with stuff like this, because every so often a company will say like, oh, we have like a new thing, oh, send us a monster and you could win vast prizes, but then they get to keep the monster and they get to publish it forever. You give the rights to them and then maybe they give you nothing because you're not one of the winners or whatever. So you want to be careful with contests like this. So these writing contests can be kind of iffy. This one definitely looks like it's on the level. A, it gives you, you maintain and own the rights to your work. They are not taking it and then running off with it and selling it for millions of dollars. Like, there's that many people making millions of dollars in this industry, but they're not grabbing it and running off with it on their own. Instead, you get to keep and maintain all of the work that you are putting into this, but have the chance to build a system. Now, to be honest, the amount of money that they're offering for this contest is pretty low for the amount of money that it takes to actually develop a good system. Like, if you win, like, let's say you're one of the winners for $2,000. If somebody were to, and I know I'm like in a different stage and other people are in different stages in their careers too, but like $2,000 is not a lot of money when it comes to building an RPG system. Like, building an RPG system is pretty, pretty, so yeah, so that's an issue. But still, like, if you definitely want to build a system, if you like this style and you want to build like an RPG around it, and you were going to do so anyway, it seems like submitting it and potentially getting an award for it might be a pretty neat thing. Their use of the Orc license is interesting. So, you know, I get a free, because my father wrote Illuminatus, I get a free conspiracy theory card that I get to use to come up with conspiracy theories. One of the tricks, and I've talked about Orc license before, I'm not going to talk about it too much, but one of the tricks with the Orc license is that the Orc license is what they call a viral license. It means that if you license your stuff, if you use material from a source that is under the Orc license, you have to release your material under the Orc license as well. And the Orc license specifically requires that any game mechanics are released under the Orc license, which means anybody can use them, including the source of the person or the source of the group that you used. So an example is, if you come up and say you come up with a really cool idea for your RPG product and you put it out under this and you get an award or you don't get an award, because you put it out under Orc, Chaosium can use your stuff. And depending on what you release, they can't use your true intellectual property like a story world or any of the non-mechanical stuff you can restrict usage of. Anything that is considered a mechanic, which can be like a monster or a spell or an item or something like that, you cannot restrict, which means anybody can use them upward and downward. Now, the interesting thing about that is usually the top of the food chain is in a better place than the people below the food chain, because they can put out a system reference document that only has the stuff they want to release and then put out a bunch of other stuff that doesn't use that. They get to use their stuff as much as they want without having to release their stuff under Orc. But you can't use their stuff that they're not releasing under Orc. You can only use the stuff that's under Orc. So would they do it? I doubt it. Again, like, I get the free conspiracy theory card. I think Chaosium is totally on the level with this. I don't think they have any intention of like, oh, we're going to get secret stuff. We're going to get some of the best designers to make RPGs, and then we're going to steal all their material and put it in our own game and make a lot of money. I don't think that that's their intention at all. I think that they're on the up and up. But it is one of those things to consider when you're working with a viral license. Is your stuff has to be released under the same restriction of the license that you want to use for other people's material. But the top of the food chain doesn't necessarily need to play by those rules, because they get to use their Orc stuff, because it's still their IP. They get to use their own Orc stuff all they want in stuff that isn't released under Orc. You don't get that same benefit. So that's one of the reasons why I'm not a huge fan of the Orc license. I much prefer when companies are using a Creative Commons attribution license that isn't viral, so that you are only, you can use whatever you want from someone else's Creative Commons document, and you can decide what parts of it you want to release under your Creative Commons document, and it is not viral. You don't have to. It's not a, you're not, that Creative Commons does have a license for that called Share Alike. The Share Alike license is a viral license, but you don't have to use that same kind of license. I don't think there's a problem with this, really. And I thought if somebody was going to go run and build a system with this, they're probably fine. It's way better than some of the other sort of sleazier programs where they're like, oh yeah, write stuff using our IP and maybe we'll give you some money, but in the meantime, we get access to all of the stuff you've created and it's ours forever. That's where things get to be a problem. So anyway, looks really neat. It's kind of a cool idea to see a, it kind of reminds me of like the Eberron thing. Like, hey, you want to build a new game world? You can, you know, build a game world with it. Eberron, it's obviously different. You know, Keith Baker wrote all of his Eberron stuff, and Wizards of the Coast owns Eberron. Now, he can still kind of write Eberron-y stuff on his Patreon and stuff like that, but really he can't be making new books without putting like on the DM's Guild. So that, you know, that's one of those things where that stuff gets passed away. I am not very good at taking notes during a game. I'm pretty good. I follow my own ideas from Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master when it comes to game prep. I go through my 8 steps. Sometimes I'll throw steps out if I don't need them. I do all of the things that I have been advising are all things that I do. I don't really have advice for, and I haven't really put out advice for, nor am I particularly good at taking notes during a game or after a game. And yet I think it's actually really important. I think that taking notes during a game and taking notes after a game are really important things that we should be doing. And I asked people on YouTube about this. I said, and I kind of posted a comment up on YouTube saying, hey, what are the kinds of notes that people take? I have some ideas, and I'm going to talk about my ideas of what are the things that we should be taking notes of during our game and how can we take those notes. But I wanted to hear what other people had to say. And I got, it turns out I didn't see common patterns. I saw a few small things, but I didn't see really common patterns for the kinds of notes that people take. So this particular video, I am curious about your take on it. Like I'm going to throw some ideas out there, but these are not hard rules for taking notes during a game. This doesn't come from decades of experience having done it well. I'm exploring this topic and I want you to explore it with me. And we're going to talk about it, and I'd love to hear comments. You can send me email or you can put comments up on YouTube and I will read them. Can't promise to respond to all of them, but I definitely want to hear more about your experiences on what's really required when taking notes during a game. My initial thought was that the only thing we really needed to take notes on were names. Names of NPCs that came up during the game that we hadn't already kept track of. Who are these NPCs? What are those names? Now, that is really important for me because I suck at remembering names. I'm just really, really bad at remembering names. And when a random name, I'm good at coming up with them because I've got random lists in front of me that have names in them, and I'll come up with a fun name and we'll all go with it, and maybe we even together modify the name a little bit and come up with something. But then I have that name and boy, I will forget it seconds later. like literally seconds later, I don't remember. I'm like, what was that guy's name again? And only if one of the players happened to jot the name down do I remember it. Or if I'm like, oh, it was that random name right there. So boy, during the game, for me, I think it's really important to write down the names of improvised NPCs. That is a really critical thing for me. I've heard other people that say that they don't really have trouble remembering the names, but they have trouble remembering the context of the NPC. Who are they? What do they want? What were their mannerisms like? What kind of accents are weird? Like when you role played them, what were some of the traits that you used to role play them? Those sorts of things they might not remember. I'm usually pretty good at that, or I kind of don't care, and I just come up with those things again later. Like, but the name is not something I can improvise. Like I can improvise the rest. I can sort of bring them back in again. And I don't think my players care too much, and I don't care too much if like the accent changes or certain things change. And usually once I remember the name, I remember what they wanted. I'm usually pretty good at getting in the heads of NPCs and sort of running, you know, role playing with the NPC off the cuff. But I can't remember that name. So really, when we're talking about the important things to take notes of, it's the things you're not going to remember. What are the things that you need to remember that you're likely to forget? Those are the things that we want to take notes on. And that could be different for all of us. That could be different for any of us that are thinking about our notes. Like, what are the things that we are not likely to remember? I'll give you another one that I'm often really bad at. Where did the game end? A lot of times I forget where the end scene was. And if I ever need something to help me roll into my prep for my next session, it's, well, where did it end? Did it end in the middle of a fight? Were we about to enter a dangerous room? Like, what happened? And for me to sit down and at the end of the game, when the game is over, just one sentence saying the characters ended walking into the great big silo that's headed down beneath Iron Fang Keep, right? Bang. Like, okay, now I remember where they are. The characters were just entering the chamber that contained one of the elven spheres that was keeping open the portal to Marrow with the intention of destroying it. Bang. All right, I've got it. So writing down those where the session ended, I think is pretty critical for me. Those two things, if I don't remember them, I'm in trouble. If I don't, and I've had this happen where I don't remember where a game ended, or I think it ended in one place and it turned out it ended somewhere else. And like I prepped a game and then I went there and like, oh my God, we were either two or three steps ahead of where I thought we were going to be, or we're in a totally different place. And I had to like really run by the seat of my pants to get us back on track to make my prep worthwhile at all. So those to me are critical ones. Anything that happened with the characters that we're not likely to remember is something that we want to write down. Again, I really feel like we should be focusing a lot of our attention on what happened with the characters. And this could be everything from like, what did they pick up when they leveled up? What magic item did they just acquire? Was there any kind of interesting character arc? Any kind of campfire tale? Those are valuable pieces of information that the players are going to remember because they're about their characters. And if we keep those in mind, it makes that first step from Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master much easier, which is character connections. If we remember, oh, that's right, we had the campfire tale. And during the campfire tale, one of the characters talked about how they were really eager to like get the hell out of a big city full of ghouls, while another character was like, I don't know, as a paladin, I feel like I'm in my element. I feel like there's no better place for me to be than in the center of a city full of undead as a paladin, because I can do more good here than I could anywhere else on the planet. That is an interesting like piece of character information that we want to write down. So I'm saying character info, but this can include everything from like leveling abilities, magic items they picked up, any sort of evolution of their character arc, any intelligent magic items. I like intelligent magic items to me are like the NPCs that just keep on giving. Like an intelligent magic item is a really great way to like have this direct relationship between the game world and the character directly that I really love. And so anything involving those intelligent magic items and remembering who their intelligent magic items were, I think is really good. Campfire tales are a good one. What do I talk about with campfire tales? So campfire tales, I'm still refining exactly how to do a campfire tale. Campfire tale is essentially like when the characters are taking a short and long rest, it's a prompt that you can ask the players to learn more about what their characters are thinking. And you want to offer, instead of just saying, look, what does Bruno think right now? That's not a great prompt, but a prompt could be, how does Bruno feel about where he is in the current situation? Or what events does it remind him of the past? And I don't have a perfect thing, but what I'm trying to get to is like with a campfire tale, I want to learn more about the history of the character and how that history relates to what they're doing now. It's that same sort of like, where have you come from? Where do you find yourself now? Where do you want to go? Almost like job interview questions, right? These can be uncomfortable questions for players. I'll ask them and I'll get like deer in headlight looks, like, I don't know. And so you don't want to jump them with it. You don't want to surprise them. You kind of want to talk about and explain what you're talking about. And then maybe have somebody jump in and then go around a table and have a list. Like if somebody has an idea, they can go with it. When it works well, and it generally does, even if it's a little uncomfortable and weird at first, it generally works well because you learn what the player thinks of the game, what the player's thinking about their character, what the character is thinking about with their interaction in the world. You're sort of diving like two levels deep. You're learning about the character and their relationship with the world. You're learning a history about the character, motivations of the character that you might not have picked up on. But also you're learning a lot about what the player feels about the game. So it's a little bit like Stars and Wishes, but it's Stars and Wishes from the point of view of the character, which gives you this really rich amount of information. And you might only get that in one or two sentences. Really, really valuable. Totally not valuable if you don't write it down. If you're not keeping track of that stuff. And this is actually one where I was pretty good at it, that when I ran Campfire Tales like this, I was pretty good about writing this stuff down. But boy, it's really good to write Campfire Tale results down, because then you can look at those at the beginning of your next session, and maybe every time you're prepping a session, take a look at what those Campfire Tales were and ask yourself, is there any sort of hooks into this Campfire Tale that the character gave me, or any sort of information that I can give that can kind of make the player enjoy the game more and kind of bring the character deeper into the world that we're going on. So I think that adding Campfire Tales is really, really important. Keeping track of loot could be something that's useful, but one of my tricks is I try to make sure that the players are keeping track of loot. I do sort of have an unwritten agreement that, like, I will hand out the loot, but it's up to you guys to decide who gets it. And if you lose a piece of loot, you lose it, right? Like, if you didn't keep track of it, you lose it. I actually think it would be really valuable to assign a player as a quartermaster. In a couple of different groups I have, one of the players has said, you know what? I will keep a spreadsheet of all the treasure that we get and who picked it up and when. And that's one of the things they do. Boy, players who are willing to do work like that are like gold. They are so useful. The same players who keep track of the notes during the session, super, super valuable. Players that are willing to keep track of the loot and who got what and keep that sort of quartermaster inventory of stuff, really, really valuable. So that's something that you can actually kind of set up in your session zero, or maybe have a couple of people, or even have like a shared spreadsheet. Like you could have like a shared, you know, Google Sheets where you're keeping track of that, so that other people can add stuff in as they go. And that way you can kind of keep track of loot as it goes as well. So what are some of the things that we probably don't need to take notes on? One of the whole principles of Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, of being a lazy dungeon master in my mind, is we refine things. We're not just about adding new work to our plate. We're about taking work away. So what are the things that we sometimes do that we don't need to do? And I have a couple of thoughts on this. One is a question came up on, should you be keeping track of what secrets you revealed and what secrets you haven't revealed yet? I actually don't worry about that, because that's not something I'm likely to forget. Or if I do, it's not a big deal. So when I look at the 10 secrets that I prepare for any given session, sometimes I'll check them off just to help me when I'm taking my notes. But I don't check them off in order to kind of keep any kind of big database of secrets so I can know, these are all the secrets that were revealed and these are all the secrets that I haven't revealed yet, and I'm going to make sure to reveal those secrets, because I don't remember them. And guess what? You don't need to remember your secrets. They're important for the game at the moment. They're not always that important for the history of the game, and they're not necessarily that important for games in the future. If they are, you're probably going to remember them. And if you're probably going to remember them, you probably don't need to write them down. So I actually don't think it matters that much in keeping track of secrets and clues, particularly which ones you revealed and which ones you don't. I really feel like that when you start a new session off, you can go back and look and be like, what secrets did I not? I use this as a lazy technique, not as a like better way of keeping the game on track sort of idea. Is I will look back at old secrets that I didn't reveal just so I don't have to write down new secrets again, just to save myself a little bit of time. But a lot of time when I look at the old secrets, I go, well, those aren't relevant anymore. They don't matter anymore. The world changed, things changed, the perspective changed, the characters went a different direction. So now I need new secrets and clues that are based in the context of the next adventure that are going on, not the ones that were important for the adventure previously. So I don't think it's that critical to, in the middle of the session, at the end of the session, to be writing down, keeping track of your secrets and clues. Something else that you probably don't need, like I think kind of the big story elements, big beats in the story, The question is like, are you going to forget those big beats in the story? Sometimes I'll do it where like, oh yeah, the characters sent an NPC off to go back to their home base. I want to remember that. I don't want to forget that they did that. So I'll write that down. So there are definitely times where like specific sort of instances of things that you might forget that you think would be fun to bring back up in the game later. Those could be fun things to write down. But I think kind of the bigger story elements, we already sort of know those, or the world is going to be evolving anyway. I don't know that those are like the critical glue that we need that sits between the session we ran, the session we're running now, and the session we're running in the future. I don't know how critical that is. I am sure there are GMs who keep track of tons and tons of stuff in their notes, and they really want to have this perfectly woven tapestry of continuity, and that you need to take a lot of notes in order to keep that tapestry of continuity down. And that's great. And like, if it works for you, that's fantastic. I'm much more of a loosey-goosey GM who just kind of lets things go and I fly by the seat of my pants, and continuity is not the most important thing to me. I would like to remember little Easter eggs when there's a like an NPC characters really like that, I think is an important thing to note, but that kind of gets into that writing down the names of NPCs and stuff like that. So those are just a few thoughts about the kind of notes that we can take during our game and after our game to kind of help us help our future selves with the prep for our next session. If you happen to be like me and you're running more than one game, it can be really critical to try to write down the information that you have going on between sessions, or the information that you need to prep your next session from your last. Or if you have, you know, more than a week or so between sessions, it can definitely help. And there's probably more things that I am forgetting. This is not an exclusive list, not a totally inclusive list of everything that you should be taking notes on either during the game or after the game. But I do offer up that think about the kinds of things that you feel if you didn't have, the game would be worse. And then think about the stuff that you might be taking notes on that you think, actually, I don't really need to worry about that so much, so that you can focus on the notes that really help you run your game. These are the things that help me with my game: writing down information about improvised NPCs, writing down where the game ended, and focusing on new information about the characters that I learned during a session that I think can help me bring those characters back into the session. Every month on the Sly Flourish Patreon, we have the monthly Patreon Q&A. Patrons can ask any RPG-related question. I answer every question every Friday morning. Some of those questions I take here to the show. Other ones become catalysts for new articles or new videos on their own. Spike H says, I am excited to say that I may be running in-person games at the local library. I'm thinking about suggesting City of Arches. It might be an open table. I was wondering if you had any advice about open tables and how best to use the City of Arches for them. First of all, thank you so much for thinking about using the City of Arches for an open table game. We actually have a friend of ours, Sharon, who is inside the Sly Flourish Discord server, the Sly Flourish Patreon Discord server, who has been running City of Arches as a local organized play game. Or yeah, I guess it's called disorganized play, but it's kind of organized. There's multiple GMs, and different GMs have been running different parts of it with different groups. So it's been kind of, but all kind of in the same shared world. And I'm very happy to hear that that's been actually going very well for them. The City of Arches really is designed to be a flexible campaign setting. Well, what is the City of Arches? The City of Arches is a city-based campaign sourcebook for 5e, built for lazy GMs, that I am writing and have delivered to patrons of Sly Flourish. They have the Patreon version of that, and I'm beginning to work on as a new book that will be kickstarted later this year. We're just starting to get the artwork in for it, and the artwork is looking really good. So the City of Arches is designed to be a very open, adventure-friendly place. It allows characters from all different origins and species and ancestries and races. It makes sense that any of them would be there because they could have come through the archway from another world without having memories of where they came from and then operate as adventurers in the world, which means the city itself can have lots of different big diversity of different people, different ancestries, different species, all that sort of thing. Different classes all make sense. So as a GM, you can really decide what components of 5e you want to bring into your game. You can bring in species from anything, but you can also bring in other classes and everything else. Everything makes sense there, was one of the design ideas, was that it wasn't necessarily I wanted to avoid the problem of you have a turtle and a herringon and a bird person and a half elemental person that are all at the bar, and the bar is all full of humans who are looking at these people like, what kind of incredible journey is this, right? I wanted it to make sense that you had all these different species from all these different places in one place. So that also extends out to being able to run it as more of an open table event. You could either run really long campaigns. There's three different first to 20th level campaign arcs in the book, but you can also run just one-shot adventures. It's built as an area to go on many different adventures in many different types of locations. Everything from small crypts up in the mountains to lost ruins down below, caves full of monsters buried inside the mountain, and then even sort of overland areas that you could go to, deserts and swamps and hillside places that exist in the area. So it is like the same diversity of the inhabitants of the city. The diversity of the style of adventures that you can run is also very, very open. You can run many, many kinds of adventures. It makes sense for why the adventures would be there. The book offers lots of the hooks that you can have. So for open table, one-shot sort of events, that can work really well. I would start, the book itself starts with like an intro scene that kind of gives people the idea of what the City of Arches is like. I kind of recommend everybody runs that as part of a session zero. It's a kind of a quick scene that just gives people an idea of who the different players are and what can kind of go on. It's really fun. Golgoron, I think is the name it's called, in which a huge first level characters witness a horned devil, big iron spike chain wielding horned devil comes through one of the archways. Really fun. So yeah, first level horned devils. So it's a lot of different ways that you could run games. And I think it also can work well because as players drop in and out, it isn't wired so tightly around one general theme that it actually can have a bunch of different things going on, and the themes can be run very loosely, which means as players kind of come in and come out, that can work really well. And it's very open for episodic gaming as well. You can really run like chapter by chapter, session by session sort of stuff that doesn't have to follow a linear path, but can instead kind of open up. Like all of those campaign threads I talked about, many of them are yam-shaped campaign threads where you can go off on a bunch of different adventures that are all leading in generally the same area without having to follow them all in a series. So yeah, I think City of Arches could work really well for that. So Spike, thank you for checking it out. Sasquatch says, I am using 3 of 6 keys for one of my fronts in my campaign, and currently the party and the baddies are at a 2-to-1 ratio in favor of the party. Say the party gets the next 2, summoning the big thing is going to get harder, but the baddies are still going to want to do it. How do you usually show the incurred cost of the villains? In my game, they are summoned in a blood they're summoning a blood avatar. So I was thinking of people sacrifices, but they kind of have endless people. So I'm trying to think of a different cost. Maybe BBEG dies for the summon. So the 3 of 6 quest keys. First of all, one thing I want to point out is the way that the X of X quest theme works is you have an odd number of items and you need the majority of them to succeed. So a 3 of 6 keys quest doesn't really work because both the characters and the villains could both have 3 keys, in which case they could still do it. So if it's a 3 of 5 keys, there's 1 key that either group requires. So in this case, if you're trying to stop a cult from succeeding, it kind of doesn't matter too much that it's not an odd number of keys with a majority. But like, let's say you needed a number of keys to open up a gateway and the players wanted to do it too, and you had 2 groups racing to do it. You wouldn't want both groups to have enough things to be able to do it. You would want 1 key being the main key. But part of it is if they acquire the keys, they win. So one of the things you ask is if the characters are 2-to-1 in favor of getting it, then one question is, you can always have the villains get one of the other keys. You can just decide it, right? You can just say, while the characters were off doing one thing, another group of the villains managed to get the other key. So now it's 2-to-2. And now, but the problem is that the players now have to get 4 of the keys to stop them. They would need to get 2 more, which might be okay, because they would have to get 2 keys before the villains got 1 key. And that's why the odd number of keys kind of is important, because now you're in this circumstance where the players actually have to get way more keys to stop the villains. If they only need to get 3, for the players to stop them completely, they have to get 4, right? Instead of just 3. But let's say they succeed. Let's say the players manage to get all of the keys they need to be able to stop the event. Well, one thing is you just have the event stop, right? That they won. They succeeded. So if the goal is to that they will always that the villains will always succeed with whatever they get, then the acquirement of the keys is kind of not important. It doesn't really matter. Now, you could have something where, like, if they got all of the keys, the avatar would be near unstoppable. And for every key the characters can get before the villains get it, the avatar is weaker and weaker and weaker. And you could even say, like, there are certain abilities that the avatar would have that if they get these keys would stop it from having those abilities. And then maybe even the characters know which abilities they are, and they can know, well, boy, if we ever have to face the avatar, we sure as hell don't want it to have X, right? We don't want it to have the death touch. So let's get the death touch key so they can't do death touches. Let's get the one where it regenerates 30 hit points a turn. We don't want it to be constantly healing. We need to stop that. We don't want the one where it has an AC of 30. So let's go stop that. So you might pick like certain criteria of the monster and tie those to the keys so that the players can slowly be working their way to building a monster they can fight rather than one that they would get defeated by. So another one is if you are doing sort of the Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master style, which is kind of loosely based on the Power by the Apocalypse style of campaign planning, you have multiple villains working on multiple things. So if one of the villains gets thwarted, it's okay that they got thwarted. That worked. So in an Eberron game I ran, we had sort of an X of X keys quest going on. And I had three different villains. And one of the villains, the characters kind of fixated on and stopped them early. And they managed to stop them early. And then we had sort of like one big final battle where the bad guys were at a severe disadvantage. They basically said, like, we're going to have to go kill the characters to get all the things that they took. And they were at a distinct disadvantage and the characters trounced them. But they had that big final battle and the players got the joy of saying, oh yeah, that they had to do this desperate ploy because we have been thwarting them all this time. And then they were no longer a villain. They were gone. But guess what? There were two other villains that were moving and then a third villain showed up. So you can always, if you have multiple villains, the multiple villains are almost like big keys and you can always have more villains and you can always, you want the players to stop the villains. So if you only have one big bad evil guy, and it's their one plan, and the characters manage to thwart the plan, then it is kind of a brittle adventure, right? But if you have multiple villains that are all working on their different parts of the plans, and as the players are thwarting one villain, other villains are getting the things that they need, now you have kind of a robust campaign that's going to go in directions you don't really know. It means that the things are going to evolve, that paths are going to go through. Now, the idea of sacrifice instead of a key works well. And actually, the idea that the big, bad, evil guy has to kill themselves to get the thing to work, I've done that too, and that can work where they're like, well, at least we didn't have to fight that guy and he had to give up everything in order to do it because he couldn't do it otherwise. I would usually want to broadcast that a little bit so that the characters know that what the loss was and what the loss would be so that they don't feel ripped off. You don't want the players to feel like they got ripped off by doing a bunch of work that didn't matter. That's really the bad thing to avoid. Don't make them feel like there wasn't a result of all of the work that they did. But if the thing still happens, but the result is, yeah, but all of the cultists who normally would have been bathing in the glory of their blood god all had to die, and now it's just the blood god, that might be enough. Like, the question is, do you think the players will feel like that was enough for them to have gone through that whole time? So that you're on the right path of thinking, like, what are the sacrifices that the people, that the villains need to do in order to get it to work is really important. But a couple of other tricks, though, like, you know, using the odd number of keys, 3 of 5, 4 of 7, 5 of 9, like those iterations of keys work. Having multiple villains that are working on them. So if one villain, not just on that set of keys, but other things too, so that if one villain is disrupted, another villain kind of stands up. And not, but mostly just not taking their agency away so that the players feel like that the victory they got. But if you think you're going to get in a situation like this, hopefully you know it early enough that you can build that idea in. Like, what if the players succeed really well? What happens with the rest of it? Is it you know, a more chaotic ending? Did they just end it? Is there something else that happens? When we're doing our campaign planning, we can think about that a little bit. Good question. Knockin says, I have a friend who loves watching actual play, but hasn't played themselves yet. They finally have expressed interest in playing, and so I'm so excited to introduce them to the game. I'm thinking of running Shadow Dark with pre-made characters in person. Any tips would bring for bringing an actual play fan into the fold? Little things to avoid. I would be a little, I love Shadow Dark. You've seen me and heard me talk about Shadow Dark all the time. If they're on board with what Shadow Dark is like, if they're on board with like character funnels and character deaths, and they understand that whole thing, that might be good. Otherwise, I really recommend Dragon of Stormwreck Isle, the new starter set for 5th edition. I've run it. I really like it. I think it does a really good job of introducing people into RPGs, but also into 5e. If you're a 5e fan, I'm a 5e fan. And it has some sort of low bar sort of ideas that you're not, their whole party's not going to get wiped out because of a bad zombie attack. I know there are people out there who are like, well, that's what D&D is like. You need to be killed by zombies, but not if you're first time, and not if like you've been watching live plays and you see all the character arcs going on. So I think it's fine initially in just learning D&D, again, depending on what the player's kind of interested in it. To introduce them with 5e and to not have all the party get completely wiped out and have the game end because they got unlucky. So I really like Dragon of Icespire Peak for that. And then something like learning about what actual plays they like, then having a conversation, what did they like about it and what are the kind of things they're interested in? Because some of them might watch like the super rich character background stuff that's been going on in like Critical Role and some of the other Critical Role based series that have gone on where they do like tons and tons of character backstory. Like that might not translate exactly the same way to your table. And you might want to make sure to get ahead of that before they get in there of like, hey, here our character arcs are, you know, because they're first level, they're pretty small. That could be kind of an important thing to recognize. One neat thing about Dragons of Stormwreck Isle is that Dragons of Stormwreck Isle has character arcs built into the pregens. And that gives them a bit of story that you can sort of run with and dance with. And I did it in our game and we really enjoyed it. So I really recommend Dragon of Stormwreck Isle. I think having a conversation with them about just mostly managing the expectations on the level of depth of character stories, which tend to be heavier depending on what live actual play they're watching, the level of character depth can be higher. Again, Critical Role being the example where the level of character depth is usually way more than you would typically see in a standard RPG. I don't think players would mind that much. I think though that getting an understanding of the rules, playing in a game, they would be. I'd be a little. I don't know. I mean, I would want to talk to them about Shadow Dark before I would start somebody off with their first experience being Shadow Dark. I would make their first experience probably. I think I would aim more for 5e than like, you know, having them die 20 times in a row because they just get hit over and over again. That can be a problem when you're running like level zero Shadow Dark games. Harrison P says, I have a location that directly ties to the deity of a cleric in the party. How can I give the player this information without giving them homework before the session or saying you, cleric, would know this before giving them some lore about the location? Love the channel. Thanks for everything. Thank you. I don't think there's a problem with saying you would know this. I actually put words in characters' heads all the time, and I think it's actually an empowering technique. I think when you say, because of your experience with the northern gods, because of your connection with the intelligent magic item that you have that has a Jotun's spirit in it, you know about this god that previously unheard of god, but you've heard of them before. You just haven't seen them named and you don't know why they're being worshipped by ghouls. That kind of thing still makes them feel like, oh, because I made these certain choices with my character, I get to learn some stuff that other people don't get to learn because they didn't make those choices. So sometimes it's not all about like leading them on, and you feel, it can feel like you're putting words in their mouth, but you're not really putting words in their mouth. You're showing them information that they get because of the choices they made as a player about their character. And I think that is really powerful. I think you don't want to do too much lore all at once. So what you can do when you have something like, I have a location that of a deity, you can take like all of the information about that deity in that location and shatter it down into small one sentence secrets and clues, then spread them out throughout the location during play, and then give them those bits of information as they play. So you're not dumping paragraphs of lore at once. Instead, you're saying like, oh, you look at a mosaic on a wall and you see a strange symbol of a wolf skull with a serpent wrapped around it, which you've recognized as like a northern god. Roll an intelligence religion check and roll with advantage because of your connection to the northern gods. And they roll, and if they succeed, then you say that is Hergrala, or whatever the god is name. I'm trying to remember. The god that, the mother of Fenrir and Hel. Somebody who's good into Norse mythology will know Fenrir, the mother of Fenrir and Hel, who is known as like the mother of grief or something like that. So you can drop that piece of lore in the game And you can give them a little bit if they fail. You can give them a lot of it if they succeed. And then you can do that all throughout the adventure. There's a little bit of like, you don't want to give too much to all the one player the whole time. So obviously there are other secrets and clues you want to sprinkle in there that other characters might be able to learn as well. But I think that that can really work. But I would not worry about putting that, or try it, right? Do the kind of thing where because you've done X, Y, and Z, you get to know A, B, and C. I think that's a totally fine way of revealing information. You don't even have to roll ability checks for it. You can just say, because you are a dwarf who has studied information about the northern gods, you know X information. I think that that's a fine workflow for passing along information that isn't putting words in their mouth, that isn't making the character do a bunch of homework, because they don't want to do a bunch of homework, and still rewards them for the choices they made about that character. So I think that is definitely a ways to go. Noisy Pants says, I'm running a Dark Sun campaign. It's my first campaign using your lazy prep process. Great. I hope it's working for you. I'm really liking it, but a problem I've had specific to Dark Sun is coming up with enough ways to drop secrets and clues in a world where most people can't read or write. Half the characters in the group can't read or write. Writing is illegal, and most people in the world can't write anyway. I can only use pictures, psionic visions, and overhearing people talking so many times. What are some other non-written ways you can share a secret? I'm going to offer to you the technique that I use that helps me considerably, which is whenever I have a hard time coming up with one thing, I instead try to come up with 10, a list of 10 things. I have another video where I talk about listing 10 things. And I challenge you to say, what are 10 ways the characters can learn stuff without having to read or write? And I bet you can come up with 10. You brought up a few. You said, you have a handful. Pictures, psionic visions, overhearing people. Well, those are three. Those aren't bad. What about like runes that are etched into an ancient weapon? I know writing is illegal, but runes aren't exactly writing. They are almost like pictograms and pictographs. You could have spirits tell them things. You could have religious iconography that teaches them things. So I have an article called Revealing Secrets. And I have 20 ways secrets can be revealed on this list. And I bet you, let's look at, for funsies, look at how many of these involve reading and writing. Mosaic on a Wall, no. Dream, no. Blind Man's Prophecy, no. Remembrance of a Time Studied in All History Book, kind of, a little bit, but maybe the history book was full of images. Statue of a Classic Hero, no. Witnesses Statement, is it written? Probably not. Rumor, no. Whispers of Gossip, no. Secret Note, that's probably anonymous. But that could be really fun, because what if the secret note, if reading and writing is illegal, but what if they are able to kind of pick up a couple of notes? That could be. Half-burned scroll on the fireplace, that's writing. Carvings on an old sarcophagus, no. Vision from an ancient obelisk, no. Taunts from lizard folk, no. Oral history shared over campfire, no. Battle cry, no. Last words of a dying foe, no. Message from the servants of the gods, no. Wise words from an old tutor, probably not. Glyphs embroidered in magical. So like only like two of these 20 are written, and that's 20 right here. But what you can do, and this might help you, because I do this technique myself, is like write down 10, make like a random list of 10 and say these are different ways. And maybe, and then if you can come up with more, do 10 more, do a list of 20 and come up with 20 ways specific to your campaign that characters might be able to pick up secrets that don't involve reading or writing. And I bet you can do it. You're a creative person. You're running a Dark Sun game. You're already creative. You already have a good creative outlet. So I think that would be a ways to do it. But that article, Revealing Secrets, offers some prompts, but then think about in your own world, like what people could find, how they could learn it, what they could pick up. But there's a lot, like the characters are smart people. They have lots of different ways they can pick things up, star signs and magical spells and lots of different ways that they can pick things up. Friends, thank you all so much for hanging out with me today while we talked about all things in tabletop role-playing games. I hope you enjoyed this show. If you did and you want more stuff like this, the best thing you can do is subscribe to the Sly Flourish newsletter. Like last week, because I missed the show, I published a newsletter version of this show, but I also post a weekly RPG-related article that has links to all of the other work that I do, and you get a free adventure generator for signing up. It's absolutely free to sign up. You can also become a patron of Sly Flourish. Patrons get access to all kinds of tools to help them run RPGs, access to exclusive adventures, previews of upcoming work, Uncovered Secrets Volume 1 and 2, the City of Arches Sourcebook, a dedicated Discord server, the Martha Q&A, tons and tons of stuff that you get for being a patron of Sly Flourish. You can also, if you sign up at the Hero tier, you get another weekly podcast called Sly Flourish's Readings and Reflections, where I read through my latest article and then reflect upon what went into the generation of that article, other ideas. It's sort of a director's cut of Sly Flourish. It's really cool. People really like it. Check that out. You can also pick up any of my books, including Return of the Lazy Dungeon Master, Lazy DM's Workbook, Lazy DM's Companion, Forge of Foes, Fantastic Adventures, Fantastic Lairs, Fantastic Locations, Ruins of the Grendel Root, T-shirts, cups, mugs, a mug, the name mug. I should use my name mug. I don't even use my own mug on my show. How terrible is that? Anyway, you should check all that out. Thank you all so much. Have a great day and get out there and play an RPG.